Thank you. Okay, welcome back. So here we go. This is the first in a series of three lectures that are dedicated to field semantics, meaning the methods and epistemology for studying linguistic meaning in the field from the native speakers. Okay, so this we already covered in the morning. I included it again here because I wasn't sure whether we would discuss it. So the various intersections between field semantics or semantic research and linguistic fieldwork. I'm not going to recap that again. Instead, I'm going to go straight to the second part, which talks about background, more background on the theory of linguistic meaning, some more understanding of what meaning is all about that we need before we can try to develop a methodology for studying semantics in the field. All right, so so this morning I said that meaning can be understood as the content of a representation being a state of affairs or an entity that stands for another state of affairs or an entity, and that information that the representation conveys about that which it stands for, which that's the meaning. Now, there is two ways of interpreting that when it comes to signs and the way people, human beings, use them, produce them, and understand them. On the one hand, we can interpret meaning in terms of referential content. So a linguistic utterance as a representation of some state of affairs in the world. And on the other hand, we can think of meaning in terms of representational content, meaning an utterance as being an external expression of an internal mental representation, a thought in the mind of the speaker. So, if I say, it's hot and humid today in Beijing, then on the one hand, I'm referring to a state of affairs in the world. I'm making a statement about the weather in Beijing in a particular place at a particular time. And on the other hand, I'm telling you what I'm thinking about that particular state of affairs in the world. Okay, so different linguists and cognitive scientists tend to emphasize one aspect of meaning or another. These lectures are dedicated to cognitive linguistics. Cognitive linguists tend to champion the representational perspective, meaning the view of meaning in terms of mental representation, and not so much the view of meaning in terms of reference. Nevertheless, I'm going to argue that if we want to study semantics empirically from the speakers without relying on our own native speaker intuitions, we have to have some handle on the referential content of linguistic utterances. Why is that? Fundamentally because as field workers, we're not mind readers. Even if we believe that the meaning is ultimately in the minds of the speakers, how do we get to these meanings? How do we get to the internal mental representations of the speaker? Well, we can't directly share them. We, generally speaking, aren't very good at telepathy. We're really lousy at telepathy, which is the reason why we have language in the first place, why we use language in the first place. So we have to reconstruct what's in the mind of the speaker through what we can observe them as referring to in the real world. That's basically the task. And my task in this lecture is going to be to flesh that out a little bit and try to make that a little more concrete. All right, so I'm going to start with the distinction between sense and reference, or Sinn and Bedeutung in the German original, that was introduced by the philosopher Gottlob Frege more than 100 years ago. And the original example that Frege gave is quite a bit involved. It goes like this. So imagine you take a triangle, any triangle, a random triangle, and you connect each angle to the center of the edge opposite that angle. So that gives you three lines, A, B, and C. And it so happens, as a property of geometry, that regardless what the triangle is that you start from, these three lines have to intersect in the same point. So that means the point in which A and B intersect is also the point in which C and B intersect is also the point in which A and C intersect. So that means that the description, the intersection of A and B, and the description, the intersection of A and C, and the description, the intersection of C and B, all refer to the same point. They all have the same reference. But of course, in every other respect, they're semantically completely different. You wouldn't actually know that they happen to have the same referent necessarily without knowing something about the geometry of triangles. Like I said, this is not necessarily the most easy example, so here are some easier examples. If I say to you, your dog just bit me. Hey, your dog just bit me. So then I'm using the word dog, and I'm using it to refer to the particular animal that I'm identifying as your dog, and that's the referent in this particular usage. But the sense, the concept in my mind is a classification, a categorization of possible reference that allows me to identify dogs and distinguish dogs from other animals and other stuff in the world, like, let's say, a lectern or a bag or something like that. So basically, the conceptual content, the sense of the word dog, somehow has to spell out criteria that allow competent speakers to distinguish possible reference of this word from those of other words. I could say instead, your pet just bit me, or your chihuahua just bit me, or your mutt just bit me. So then I'm using different words, all of which have different senses. So I'm making a different conceptual categorization. I'm categorizing the referent in a different way. But it's always the same referent. On the other hand, let's say a different conversation. Again, I'm talking to you, but now I'm saying, hey, Sally's dog just bit me. So now I'm talking about a different dog. So now I'm using the word dog again, same conceptual classification, but different referent. Now, this sentence does not make sense for all native speakers of English, but it does apparently to some. Sam's not a dog, she's a bitch. That makes sense if you have a polysemous representation of the word dog in your mental lexicon such that it has one meaning which refers to the species that we call dogs, and another in which it refers more narrowly to the male members of that species. So it has a separate sense, male dog, and under that sense, this makes sense. So that means now I'm using the same word, but with a different sense. That's the phenomenon of polysemy, which we'll talk about some more. All right, so that's the distinction between sense and reference. Now there's a related distinction which was introduced by a student of Frege's, Rudolf Carnap, a little later, and that's the distinction between extension and intension. Extension is a useful term which we'll be using a lot in semantic typology. It's the set of possible reference of a term. So if the word that you're looking at is dog, then the extension of that would be all the possible critters that this word could be applied to. And of course, if there are metaphorical uses of dog, let's say for insulting somebody or for saying, well, that person actually is being treated poorly by somebody else, something like that, those would also all be included in the extension of dog. All right, on the other hand, you have the intention. Now, the intention is Carnap's equivalent of sense. It's the criteria that allow people to identify possible reference, which is the conceptual contents in Frege's sense, except Carnap gave a more formal account, which in the modern tradition of formal semantics has been interpreted as a function from possible worlds to reference. So you take a word and you put it in different contexts, you evaluate it with respect to different possible worlds, and the function assigns a set of possible reference in each world. Let's say one world there's only one dog, one world there are 100 million different species of dogs, one world is more or less like ours, and so on and so forth. This is not a very useful notion for our purposes, for the purposes of semantic typology. It's a notion that has been used to sort of gloss over the issue of sense in formal semantics. Formal semanticists aren't very comfortable talking about sense because sense is conceptual content. Formal semanticists are generally not very comfortable with conceptual content since they don't have a whole lot to say about that. Something we'll talk a little more about shortly. So the concept of intention as opposed to sense is not very useful for semantic typology, but the concept of extension, the sense, the set of possible reference, is, for reasons that will become clear as we go along. And finally, there's also the concept of denotation, which is again a notion that comes out of formal semantics, and it talks about the class of possible reference and what these have in common. Again, that's not necessarily a particularly useful notion for our purposes. Now, here's a model. A traditional model for thinking about the relationship between sense and reference, which goes back all the way to Aristotle. Aristotle originally proposed that in one of his books, which is called Perihamenaios in Greek, in the Latin translation, De Interpretatione, on interpretation, something that I'll get back to. Much more recently, this idea of the semiotic triangle was revived by Ogden and Richards in one of the classic books on semiotics. The idea is basically that symbols only associate to reference, such as words having reference, for example, the word cat referring to a particular animal, via some conceptual content in the mind of the speaker. So you cannot get, that's the idea of the semiotic triangle, you cannot get from the symbol to the referent without some sense mediating between it. This is an idea that's been hugely controversial in modern philosophy. A lot of smart arguments have been advanced to the effect that this isn't always true, but it's certainly true in some cases. So that means here's a more abstract version of the semiotic triangle. There are two fundamental axes to meaning, which we've already introduced. Meaning is a relation between linguistic expressions and mental content. That's meaning as representation, and meaning as a relation between linguistic expressions and reference, in reality or maybe in imagined reality. And so that's the view of meaning as reference. Now, meaning as mental representation is an approach that's been championed by what have been called variously internalist semanticists or representational semanticists, conceptual semanticists, cognitive semanticists, and so on and so forth. And these are people who work primarily on phenomena that can be explained with respect to the properties of the underlying mental representations or cognitive representations in the mind of the speaker. Semantic properties that can be explained with reference to cognition, such as lexicalization. This morning I mentioned Berlin and Kay's classic study on color terminologies. That's a problem of lexicalization. Lexicalization is the availability of words or constructions, linguistic expressions for concepts, a relation between concepts and linguistic expressions in particular languages. And of course, in the case of Berlin and Case research, the question is, what words do different languages have available in the mental lexicon of the speaker to refer to color senses? So that's a problem of lexicalization. Semantic transfer, metaphor and metonymy, a huge topic in cognitive linguistics. Formal semanticists have nothing to say about this because it's not a problem that can be explained in terms of reference to the world. It's entirely in the mind of the speaker. It's entirely a cognitive problem. Very strongly related, polysemy, the multitude of senses that you encounter in a single word and the relationship between these senses. Semantic change, evolution of the family of senses of a word over time, and how we explain these changes. Prototypicality effects, meaning distinctions in terms of the extension, a structure in the extension of an expression such that some reference are more prominent, more salient, better exemplars of the category than other members. This morning I mentioned Eleanor Roche's work on prototype theory in categorization in psychology, which in turn was inspired by Berlin and Kay's work on lexicalization. Taxonomies, the structure of taxonomies, families of concepts, such as, let's say, from life form, you go to animal and, I don't know, that doesn't make sense. Let's say, mammal, fish, bird, insect, something like that. And from mammal you go to dog and cat and horse. And from dog you go to, dachshund and golden retriever and something else. You get the general idea. So that's a classification of concepts in terms of relations of superordinate and subordinate concepts. That's a taxonomy. Meronymies, meaning part-whole structures in their linguistic expression. All of these are problems that formal semanticists have very little or nothing to say about, and that have been given very insightful treatments in the cognitive or conceptual internalist traditions. Here are some of the main people in cognitive approaches to semantics: Manfred Bierwisch, Ray Jackendorf, George Lakoff, Len Talmy, Anna Wischwitzka, and these two, of course, have been prior speakers in this forum. On the other hand, meaning as reference, that's the approach that's been championed in formal or compositional semantics. And let me, by the way, just insert here that the term formal semantics is often misunderstood. Formal semantics does not mean you're using a formal meta-language. Formal semantics means you're talking about meaning as contributed by the form of language. In other words, the morphosyntactic form. So we're talking about the semantic impact of syntax, by and large. That's why formal semantics is compositional semantics, according to the principle of compositionality, which was also introduced by Frege. So formal semanticists have looked at problems such as scope ambiguity, and quantification has been a staple in formal semantics since its inception, because the standard formal meta-language is predicate calculus, which was developed by Frege, among others, in order to deal with the problem of quantification in logic. So you have a sentence such as, every linguist has watched an episode of Red Dwarf, and that has two interpretations. One, according to which there's a single specific episode that has been watched by every linguist, and another under which every linguist has watched at least one episode of this show, but not everyone has watched the same episode. Right? So accounting for these different interpretations has been one of the issues that formal semanticists have worked on. Entailment patterns is another. If you say Sally was watching Red Dwarf, that entails that Sally watched Red Dwarf. It's not possible for this one to be true without this one also being true. But if you say Sally was watching an episode of Red Dwarf, then it doesn't necessarily follow that Sally watched an episode of Red Dwarf. Why not? Because, you know, Sally might have been watching an episode of Red Dwarf when the fuse blew and the TV went dark and she couldn't finish the episode. So she never found out what happened in the end. Red Dwarf is a British sci-fi sitcom of the 1980s, for those who don't know it. Very good show. Very irreverent, very funny, very trashy. Okay, sorry. Implicatures and presuppositions. If you say Floyd has watched some episode of Red Dwarf, some episodes of Red Dwarf, that implicates, it strongly suggests, but does not entail that he didn't watch all episodes of Red Dwarf. In fact, it is entirely possible. I mean, if it is in fact true that Floyd watched all the episodes of Red Dwarf, then it necessarily also follows that he watched some of them. So the phenomenon here is a scalar implicature, an implicature to the most informative interpretation of the utterance, according to the theory of generalized conversational implicatures that was developed by the philosopher Grice and published in the 1970s, although he had been working on it for a much longer period of time. And then syntactic compatibility issues such as Sally watched Red Dwarf for 20 minutes versus Sally watched the episode of Red Dwarf in 45 minutes. So the change here between the preposition for and the preposition in is something that is engendered by the role of telicity in English syntax, which is not a universal phenomenon. It does not apparently apply to Mandarin. It does not apply to Yucatec, for example, Yucatec Maya, the language I've been studying in the field for a long time. But some languages do have this distinction, and formal semanticists have tried to explain why that is, although they haven't had a huge amount of success at that. And by the way, Ray Jackendorf, one of the conceptual semanticists, has also come up with an insightful treatment of this problem. Anyhow, so here are some of the more prominent people in formal semantics: Irene Heim, Hans Kamp, Angelika Kratzer, Manfred Kryfka, Barbara Patti. All right. It so happens that, well, it doesn't just so happen. Internal semanticists work mostly, internalist, conceptual, mentalist semanticists work mostly on problems of lexical semantics, whereas formal semanticists work mostly on problems of compositional semantics, meaning the semantic impact of syntactic structure. The reason for this is, formal semantics is by definition about compositionality, and on the other hand, tends to have very little to say about the issues most prominent in lexical semantics, such as semantic transfer, lexicalization, and so on and so forth, because those semantic properties can apparently only be given satisfactory explanations with reference to properties of the mind. All right. Now, I'm going to have to... I should say at this point that for many people, this is the opposition between these two approaches to meaning, the internalist and the externalist, the internalist in terms of mental representation and the externalist in terms of representations of external reality. Many people on both sides, champions of both approaches, have framed this as an issue of right or wrong, an issue of one approach is the correct one and the other people are confused and misguided. For example, Jackendorf and Lakoff have lambasted the formal semanticists as objectivists, people who supposedly necessarily believe in objective truth. And some people, prominent people in formal semantics, do in fact believe in objective truth and think that it's necessary for semanticists to believe in objective truth. What the mentalist is doing is basically not science. What can I say? I don't share this view at all. I'm happily working in both of these traditions, more in the conceptualist tradition, because being somebody who's interested in semantic typology, that's where most of the research has been. But I've also done some work in formal semantics, and personally, I like it very much. It's just that I don't believe that one excludes the other. I actually think that these are complementary perspectives on linguistic meaning, and the perspective of meaning in terms of reference and the perspective in terms of conceptual representation are two pictures, both of which are required for a full understanding of the phenomenon of linguistic meaning. All right, now, this is where we get to field semantics, leaving the preparations, the background behind. And the problem that I want to talk about centrally today is what Lisa Matthewson has called relativist agnosticism. Lisa Matthewson is a formal semanticist who works on Native American languages, and she published a paper in the premier journal on the study of Native American languages, the International Journal of American Linguistics. And in that paper, she attacks the position that she calls relativist agnosticism, which is the view that you cannot study meaning without native speaker intuitions. You have to be a native speaker of the language in order to study meaning in that language. And this is something that I encounter a lot. And it causes me to laugh quietly, but at the same time, it also can cause a lot of frustration. I understand this view very well, I think, and I try to help people extricate themselves from this belief that it's impossible to study meaning unless you're actually a speaker of the language. But let's try to understand where this idea comes from. And to understand that, you have to take into account a little bit of the history of linguistics, and more specifically, the place of linguistics in academia, which is kind of interesting, because we're sort of between the fronts. What fronts am I talking about? The fronts between the sciences and the humanities. The sciences, both the natural sciences and the social sciences, are invested in observation. They are empirical approaches to the data, the truth, the reality, knowledge. The aim of science is to accumulate knowledge on the basis of observation, whereas the aim of the humanities... there's something missing here. That's interesting. There's something here that doesn't get projected. Okay. The aim of the humanities is to accumulate knowledge on the basis of interpretation. And that's where the word hermeneutic comes in for the method of studying the knowledge of accumulating knowledge on the basis of interpretation, which is the dominant method, for example, in the study of law, because what does the study of law consist of? You look at the legal precedent or the intent of the framers of the Constitution, and you're trying to discern from that how a law is supposed to be applied to a particular case at hand. That's what jurisprudence is all about. Or take philosophy, right? Philosophy, if you go take a class about Aristotle or Marx or Heidegger, well, you're going to read the words of these philosophers and you're trying to make sense of what they're saying. So you're interpreting it. That's basically your aim. Same in art history. You're interpreting the works of Michelangelo or some other famous painter, and so on and so forth. Hermeneutic is the technical term for the method of deriving knowledge from interpretation. And this is a term that was coined by Aristotle in that book that I was referring to earlier, Perihamenaios. On interpretation. The folk etymology of this term goes back to the Greek god Hermes in the Roman pantheon, Mercury, the messenger of the gods. As a messenger, of course, Hermes conveys messages, which is what the interpreter has to, or rather, the interpreter has to discern the intent of the message of the author of the message. So, what about linguistics? Well, linguistics is situated here under the social sciences, but as a matter of fact, linguistics as a modern discipline, if you take a slightly broader view and assume that linguistics got its start in the 19th century, then it did so very much as historical linguistics. In the 19th century, all of linguistics was historical linguistics, and historical linguistics was firmly seated under the humanities. And the move of linguistics into the social sciences is really something that didn't happen until the 1960s. And you could say that the Chomskyan turn in linguistics, or the Chomskyan revolution, was a bit of a catalyst in this development, but at the same time, the Chomskyans actually always remained in the humanities tradition. The methodological emphasis of the Chomskyan research program on native speaker intuitions as the primary source of the linguist's data, that's something very much in line with the entire humanities tradition. And the people who actually moved linguistics into the social sciences, or started moving linguistics into the social sciences, were people a little bit more on the edges of mainstream linguistics, such as Billabov, the sociolinguist, and Roger Brown, the pioneer of psycholinguistics and child language research. Alright, so nowadays we've had linguistics drifting more and more into the social sciences, and over the last 20 years we've seen a real empiricist turn, not just in linguistics but in the entire cognitive sciences, which I think is a very healthy development. And this empiricist turn has accelerated the move of linguistics out of the humanities into the social sciences. But a lot of our traditions are still here, and that's what's responsible for this kind of thinking, because if you assume that our primary access to the meaning of linguistic utterances is in terms of interpretation, then of course that means the best interpretation, the most accurate interpretation, has got to be the interpretation of the native speaker. So if you're not a native speaker of the language, how can you do that? On the other hand, if you take the perspective of a social or behavioral scientist, well, look, semantics is behavior. Using an utterance to convey something about something is behavior. How do you study human behavior? You study human behavior on the basis of what can be observed, and from there you try to infer the underlying knowledge and representations and so on and so forth in the mind of the speaker. There is no difference between semantics and any other form of human behavior in that respect. So from a social and behavioral science perspective, there is no difference between a semanticist studying their native language and studying any other language. Obviously, if they have no knowledge of the language, it's going to be a lot harder. But at some point, they have to start from having no knowledge of the language if they ever want to be get to a position where they have some knowledge. And that's true not just of the linguist, but it's also true of the native speakers themselves, because they start out as babies, not knowing much of anything about the meanings of the meanings that are expressed in their native languages. And how do they get to the point where they understand the meanings conveyed in the semantic system of their language, the language they are learning? Well, they get to the point via the observation of competent speakers, their parents, their older siblings, and so on and so forth. I want to argue that the position that we as field semanticists in is actually no different from the position that any empirically oriented, empirically working semanticist is in. And that position, in turn, is not fundamentally epistemologically different from the position of a child learning the semantic system of her, the language of her, the language in which she is being socialized. Fundamentally, all of us, what we have to do, because we suck at telepathy, we're not very good at telepathy, we cannot directly share mental representations. So what we have to do is we have to reconstruct the mental representations, the senses of linguistic expressions from the observable referential correlates, the stuff that people seem to refer to. And I'm not saying that's easy, but it's possible. Alright. So let's take a quick look at some actual examples from child language development. Basically, what happens any time somebody forms a category is you typically get this kind of U-shaped learning curve where you... here you have your time axis, and here you have the percentage of uses that's correct. And you start out somewhere around 50%, and then the percentage of correct usage drops sharply before it goes up and finally reaches 100%. Why is that? Because in the beginning, all you do is you reproduce the input. You reproduce what you've heard other people do. So that means, let's say you're going to use the word bottle, but you're going to use it as a proper name. You're going to use it just as the name of the particular bottle that you heard your mom refer to. Right? Or you use the word teddy only for a particular teddy bear. And then, aha, the kid figures out that, in fact, this isn't just a proper name. There's a whole category here. There's a rule, a productive rule that allows the application of this concept to an infinite set of reference. And so the kid tries to aim for the right generalization. And of course, initially she aims too high. And that's why the percentage of correct usages now drops sharply. So you get overgeneralizations, such as the kid using dog not just for dogs, but also for lambs, cats, wolves, and cows. Why? Because she interprets this word as meaning quadruped. Or, this is from Melissa Bowerman's diaries of her own daughters, kick being used for the kicking of a ball, but also the fluttering of a moth, cartoon turtles doing the can-can, making a ball roll by bumping it with the front wheel of a kiddie car, and so on and so forth. So in other words, at this point, what the kid is missing is that kick only refers to actions that are conducted with the foot. Instead, the kid assumes that kick refers to any kind of sharp movement. All right, sharp sudden movement. So this process, from under-generalizations to over-generalizations to eventually the right level of generality. This is basically what Roger Brown tried to capture half a century ago with his original word game, which he described as follows. The tutor names things, the tutor being a competent speaker of the language, the tutor being the parents, the caregivers, the older siblings, any speakers the kid observes. The tutor names things in accordance with the semantics customs of the community. The player forms hypotheses about the categorical nature of the things named, tests these hypotheses by trying to name new things correctly. Tutor compares the player's utterances with his own anticipations of such utterances, and in this way checks the accuracy of fit between his own categories and those of the player, etc., etc. This is fundamentally exactly what we have to do as field semanticists. So we test what an expression can refer to by examining what a real or imagined situation has to be like in order for the expression to be part of a truthful description of the situation according to native speaker intuitions. I'm going to talk more about this notion of truthfulness here, which is a philosophically dicey one, obviously. But so fundamentally, we observe speakers use linguistic expressions to refer to the world, and then we manipulate the world in order to see how that affects their usages. And that way we test our hypothesis about the underlying rules in the minds of the speaker. Here's a slightly more elaborate version of this idea. So you present the speaker with a stimulus. This is actually one of the pictures from the stimuli we developed in the project on the representation of space in Mesoamerican languages that I've been working on for the last few years. So it shows a ball and a chair, and the question is, what's the spatial relation between these? And so the speaker responds to this stimulus using an utterance. What's mediating between the stimulus and the utterance is the speaker's semantic system, their mental lexicon, mental grammar, and pragmatic competence. Excuse me. But of course, these things we as semanticists cannot directly observe. So what we have to do is we have to infer them from the relationship between the stimulus and the observable utterance. So what we do is we form a hypothesis about these mediating systems, and we test this hypothesis by changing the stimulus and finding out how this affects what the speaker is saying here. All right, so this means fundamentally that observational data, meaning any data that an empirical semanticist has to work from, is necessarily extensional data. It's data about possible reference in the broadest possible sense. The fundamental goal of the empirical semanticist and the semantic typologist is to infer senses, concepts, the underlying concepts from the observable extensions. And let me give you an example of that. So this is two sets of data collected with the topological relations picture series, affectionately known as BAUPAD, after the two authors, Melissa Bauman and Eric Patterson. It's a set of pictures that show different spatial configurations of objects. And the participant's task is always to identify where one particular object is located with respect to another object. These are data sets produced by two speakers of Mexican Spanish, so both from the same variety, same dialect of Spanish. And you see there's a vast difference here in terms of this person using in the preposition in for everything that this speaker uses in for, but in addition also for these kinds of attachment configurations for which this speaker, the speaker on the left, uses colgado de or other expressions, and all of these cases of support for which the speaker on the left has sobra. All of this is included in the domain of the extension of N on this side. So, question, does that mean that the speaker, the two speakers, have different mental lexicon entries for the preposition in? The answer is most likely no. Rather, what's happening here is that this speaker is much more specific. They're using the preposition in only for those instances where it's most informative. And for all the other ones where there are more informative alternatives, they use those alternatives. In other words, what's generating the narrow extension here is one of those scalar implicatures that I mentioned earlier. So, in principle, and we're going to see this in more detail later on, one of the important aspects of isolating the sense from the extensional data is to filter out pragmatic meaning components such as implicatures from the extensional data. Filter out, distinguish between the semantic and the pragmatic meaning components. All right, so over the years, a number of important objections have been raised against the possibility of doing semantics on the basis of extensional observational data. So a number of different people have argued that's actually not possible. You cannot do this. One of them was the philosopher Willard Van Orman Quine, who argued all the way back in 1960 that when you're observing an utterance, you cannot necessarily be sure what the speaker is referring to. That's the problem of referential indeterminacy. Let's say you see a rabbit running by, and the speaker goes blah. The speaker says something. So how do you know that the speaker is referring to the rabbit, the animal, rather than the fact of the rabbit running, or maybe the suddenness of the rabbit's motion, or something like that? That's the problem of referential indeterminacy. Another important objection that has been raised, and that's important in particular in the context of cognitive linguistics, because it's been advocated by very influential people in this field, such as Lakoff and Jackendorf, that's the objectivism charge. So the claim is specifically that if you're doing semantics on the basis of referential data, you're making a commitment to the existence of an objective reality. But that doesn't make sense because language doesn't care about objective reality. Language construes reality. Therefore, linguistic meaning cannot possibly depend on objective reality. And that's correct, but as I'm going to argue shortly, the objection is based on a misunderstanding of the relationship between meaning and truth. It's not actually the case that meaning presupposes truth. On the contrary, the truth of linguistic utterances presupposes their meaning, depends on their meaning. So you don't actually need to be invested in the philosophical position that there is an objective reality, or that we as humans have access to that objective reality. You don't need to believe in objective truth in order to do externalist semantics. Notwithstanding the fact that some of the people who do externalist semantics actually do believe that you have to be invested in an objective truth. But for now, here's my main argument. This is, take it for what it's worth. It's not the most subtle, it's not the most sophisticated argument in the world, but my argument is, if kids can do it, so can we. Somehow, despite of whatever merits these objections might have, the kids are able to learn the semantic system of their native language. And even if you believe in innate conceptual categories, there's no question that the vast majority of meanings expressed in language cannot possibly be innate. The meanings of lexical expressions have got to be learned. Most of the functional category system, the meanings of function words and inflections have got to be learned. The meanings of constructions, so on and so forth. Somehow, kids figure it out. If they can, so can we. The linguists and even the philosophers, in principle, can figure it out. That doesn't mean that I know exactly how to do it, but I think it's possible. The last part is where I get to talk a little bit more about this controversial and very thorny issue of the relation between meaning and truth. All right, so the idea that meaning and truth have something to do with one another is a very old idea, goes back all the way to Aristotle and probably beyond. Although people haven't really didn't turn it into a serious research program until the mid-20th century, when this guy, Alfred Tarski, a very important logician, developed a formal approach to, interpreting logic set theoretically, in terms of set theory. And you can take that basically as a semantics for formal languages, because logic is concerned with inference rules, and formal logic is concerned with inference rules that depend on the meanings of statements in formal languages, such as predicate logic. So what model theory does is a way of representing the meaning of linguistic linguistic utterances, but in Tarski's sense, not natural language utterances, but just formal statements, statements in some formal language, in terms of the conditions under which this statement is true. Alright, so the basic idea, if I say there's a goldfish in my bathtub, there's a set of situations in which this can be true, and that set of situations is going to be distinct from the set of situations under which this other statement is true. There's a whale in my bathtub. Now, the interesting thing about this from the perspective of natural language semanticists is that speakers have ideas about the set of conditions under which one statement or another is true. And you can use these intuitions in order to work your way backwards, reconstructing the meanings of these expressions. In this case, the semantic difference between goldfish and whale. So this is based on the correspondence theory of truth, which says that truth is a relation between representations and that which they represent. Namely, a representation is true if it is an adequate representation of that which it stands for, which is philosophically naive, but it has the intriguing property of actually predicting the intuitions of native speakers when it comes to linguistic utterances. All right. So, people's intuitions for the truth conditions of a sentence are a representation, a measure, a function of their intuitions about the meanings or their knowledge of the meanings of the utterance, and more specifically the meanings of the constituents and the way these constituents are combined in the utterance. So by describing these intuitions and by testing how the intuitions change depending on the conditions under which the utterance is used, for example, the stimulus that the speaker is referring to or the task that you're giving the speaker, you can make inferences about the meanings of the expressions that are involved in these utterances. So, in other words, empirically, truth conditions are a way of getting at speakers' intuitions, speakers' knowledge of the meanings of linguistic expressions. Now, are they an exclusive way? No. Are they an infallible, always reliable way? No. Are they a problematic way? Yes. They are problematic, for example, because there are serious limits to the relationship between meaning and truth. For example, the truth conditions of an utterance depend on the extension of the utterance. Now, there can be expressions that have identical extensions but different senses. And those expressions are going to have identical truth conditions, and their semantic difference is not reflected in these truth conditions. Example, the glass is half full and the glass is half empty. Now, clearly, these two utterances mean different things. And yet, think about it, there is no possible situation in which one of these is true without the other also being true in the same situation. So, they have identical truth conditions, exactly identical truth conditions, even though their meanings are complementary. Similarly, Crichton is a mechanoid, and Crichton is a mechanoid, and he's not an anteater. Now, if you know anything about logic, of course, you know, why is this a goofy example? Because it's an example from logic, and logicians like to make goofy examples. Logic is a bit dull, so you have to entertain yourself. So if you know anything about logic, you know that there is no possible way for one of these statements to be true without the other also being true. Every possible world, every possible situation in which one of these is true is one in which the other is also true. And yet, obviously, they don't mean the same thing. To make matters much, much worse, many utterances, maybe most utterances, are neither true nor false. They, in fact, cannot possibly be true or false because they're not representations of state of affairs. And of course, what I'm talking about here is non-representational speech acts in terms of John Langshaw Austin's theory of speech acts. So consider these ones. The question, is Crichton a mechanoid? That's neither true nor false. It's asking the addressee whether the underlying proposition is true or false. Crichton, be a mechanoid. Crichton is a figure of this 1980s TV show, Red Dwarf, that I mentioned earlier. Obviously, this is neither true nor false. Crichton, you silly mechanoid. I bet you $5 Crichton is a mechanoid. So this is a speech act, a performative speech act that offers a bet. And clearly, you cannot continue felicitously by saying, well, that's true, I agree, or no, you're wrong about that. None of these moves would be felicitous in this context. In addition, there are important meaning components that are non-truth conditional because they are pragmatic, not semantic meaning components, such as presuppositions. Presuppositions are basically propositions that speakers and addressees have to take for granted in order to make sense of linguistic utterances, regardless of whether they're true or false or neither. For example, if I say Sally chased the squirrel out of her yard, then that implies that there was a squirrel in Sally's yard. But if I say Sally didn't chase the squirrel out of her yard, that also implies that there was a squirrel in her yard. Excuse me. If I ask the question, did Sally chase the squirrel out of her yard, that again presupposes that there was a squirrel in her yard. So this particular meaning component, the preposition there was a squirrel in Sally's yard, is a presupposition, is something that we have to assume in order to make sense of the first utterance. But it's not an entailment, it's not a truth conditional meaning component. Similarly, implicatures, and we've already mentioned these several times today. Floyd has watched some episodes of Red Dwarf and doesn't entail but implicates that Floyd hasn't watched all episodes of Red Dwarf. In fact, excuse me, if the speaker actually knows that Floyd has watched all of the episodes, then why aren't they saying so? Why are they saying Floyd has watched some episodes of Red Dwarf? Either they want to convey they're probably trying to convey that Floyd didn't watch all of the episodes, and if that isn't true, then maybe they're trying to mislead the addressee, or maybe they are being confused about what's going on here. But the most likely interpretation that the speaker is trying to convey is this one. But you only get to this interpretation on the basis of a pragmatic principle that enriches the utterance, the meaning of the utterance in context, and that's a generalized conversational implicature, namely, in this case, a scalar implicature. Um, Okay, actually, the example I wanted to illustrate here was a different example, but never mind. That one, the one I just gave you, does the trick. Okay, so so we see that truth conditions are at best a relatively poor and problematic expression, if you will, of the meaning of linguistic utterances. Nevertheless, if we assume that as empirical semanticists, we have to rely on what the speaker is referring to, on the extension or referential content of their utterances, in order to try to reconstruct the underlying meaning, the sense, the conceptual representation in the mind of the speaker from the observed extensional uses, then the truth conditions are an important empirical pathway that we have to rely on. Now, I've already mentioned the rejection of truth conditions as an access route to linguistic meaning by many prominent mental or conceptual semanticists because of the objectivism charge, because of the argument that, you cannot actually study meaning in terms of truth conditions unless you rely on some objective notion of truth. And I said before, actually, this is a misunderstanding because it's not the case that the meaning of an utterance depends on its truth. It's the other way around. The truth depends on the meaning. So when we study the meanings of linguistic utterances, we can use the speaker's intuitions of the conditions under which the utterance might be used to make a truthful statement about the world as an indirect representation of their meaning, whether or not the situation is actually true. As a matter of fact, I didn't put that on the slide here, but think about fiction. Think about a page out of Tolkien's the Fellowship of the Ring, or I don't know, Tolstoy's Anna Karenina, or what have you. Any sentence out of any work of fiction, you as a reader of this novel, or maybe even this poem, are going to have... let's stick with novels, because poetry is a different story. So you as a reader of this novel are going to have a very precise idea of the conditions under which this particular sentence in this particular novel would be true. In the story context, you're going to be able to evaluate whether the statement is true or not, even though you know it's fiction. Right? So, clearly, it's not the case that in order to study meaning via truth conditions, you have to first believe that there is such a thing as truth. Nor do you necessarily have to rely on sharing an understanding with an understanding of truth with the native speakers of the language that you study. Although this is a little bit more iffy. But my claim is that speakers of all languages have an understanding of what you can pragmatically do with linguistic utterances. And one of the things that language evolved to do is to allow people to communicate, to exchange ideas about stuff out there in the world. And people use linguistic utterances more faithfully or less faithfully, maybe misleadingly, maybe they're mistaken, and so on and so forth. At this level, everybody who uses a natural language seems to have some sort of working understanding of the pragmatics of using language. And that's something that we can study without necessarily having to answer these knotty philosophical questions about truth. All right, so the short of it is, I'm claiming that the relation between meaning and truth is that the truth of a sentence depends on its meaning, and the meaning is independent of the truth. Therefore, it's not the case that studying linguistic meaning via the conditions that have to be fulfilled in order for a sentence to make a truthful statement, or speaker using that sentence to make a truthful statement, requires a commitment to something like objective truth. All right, that's pretty much it. So the summary, field semantics is the elicitation of semantic data from native speaker consultants and the semantic analysis of these data based on the consultant's intuitions for things such as entailments or contradictions and pragmatic felicity. This is something that we'll talk more about today, tomorrow. This is going to be the big topic of tomorrow. How exactly, based on what data, using what diagnostics and tests and so on and so forth, can we get from the observed extensions to the underlying conceptual representations in the mind of the speaker. We introduced the distinction between referential and representational content. So, on the one hand, we can view linguistic meaning in terms of direct reference to external state of affairs, and on the other hand, we can view it in terms of external representations of the speaker's internal thoughts about the external state of affairs. We introduce the notion of extension, intention, and sense. The extension is the set of possible reference of a linguistic expression. The sense is the underlying concept or mental representation that the speaker taps into when interpreting the utterance, and that generates the set of possible reference. The intention is something that we don't need in semantic typology and in conceptual semantics, but that formal semanticists often use to have something they can formalize instead of sense, which is a conceptual notion, something that you can't formalize. I talked about the empirical basis of field semantics. I argued that field semanticists have to infer senses from observable extensions, since they aren't mind readers, at least usually they aren't. And to achieve this, they have to manipulate the real or imagined situations under which native speakers use linguistic utterances. And from there, uncover native speakers' intuitions about the applicability of certain expressions in reference to these particular situations. The relation between meaning and truth and the objectivism charge, truth depends on meaning, not vice versa. Therefore, externalist approaches to meaning don't necessarily entail a commitment to objectivist notions of truth. And once again, I'm not trying to turn you all into externalists or formal semanticists or people who believe in truth conditions. What I'm trying to say is, we're going to have to use reference, we're going to have to use extensional data as a first step in uncovering linguistic meanings in the minds of the speakers, the same way children do when they learn the semantic system of the languages they grow up to speak. And that is something that is possible without a philosophical commitment to something like objective truth.